The first argued case this morning is number 21-1779, Butte County, Idaho, against the United States. Mr. Saltman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is a case involving the Department of Energy's failure to make a statutorily mandated annual impact assistance payment to Butte County under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982. Appellant will show that its claims were timely filed and that this court has jurisdiction and that appellant is entitled to those impact payments because DOD established federal interim storage capacity in Butte County and they operated that capacity, and this is just the sort of thing for which the NWPA was enacted.
I wonder whether this statute is really money mandating.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It was money mandating?
Okay. I'll tell you why I wonder that.
Okay.
Because as I read the statute, it's discretionary with the Secretary as to how much to pay out to individual government entities.
Your Honor.
There's a maximum amount that can be paid out.
That's correct.
But there's no minimum amount.
There's no minimum, that's correct.
If there's a situation, there are some cases that suggest that if there's no fixed sum to be collected, then it's not money mandating. The statute's not money mandating.
So I think that it's money mandating in the sense that it does require some payment.
But could be negligible, right?
That is true, Your Honor. It could be negligible, but it is money mandating in that the Secretary does not have the discretion to pay Butte County zero.
Well, I realize that this is not an issue that's been addressed in the briefs, but are you aware of any case that says a statute is money mandating when there's an indeterminate amount and no minimum amount to be paid?
An indeterminate amount. I'm aware of cases where the amount has yet to be determined, but I'm not aware of cases necessarily where the amount could go as low as a dollar. Maybe that's true. That's not true. I'm thinking about the PILT statute that was in the Greenlee County case, which Your Honor may be familiar with. In that case, the amount to be paid was yet to be determined. It conceivably could have gone down to as low as a dollar, and yet this court took jurisdiction of it.
Okay.
That case was in 2007, I believe, and I'm sorry I don't have the citation to it, but I can get that for you
okay.
If you'd like.
Thank you.
Why does this court have jurisdiction? This case fits squarely within the paradigm of a continuing claim under Freedman versus United States, as that case has been adopted or supported by Hatter versus United States, an en banc decision. The case turns on a pure question of law.
Could you just back up? What is your theory that the government failed to comply with the statute by issuing the kind of contract that would require payments into the fund?
That's really not the heart of the case, Your Honor. The heart of the case is that they established and operated this capacity consistent with the terms of the statute, and that kicked in the payment obligation of the United States.
I'm not sure that I follow that. Is the theory that they failed to enter into the kind of contract that the statute required, or that this contract should be considered to be the kind of contract?
The contract is almost secondary, Your Honor. In the sense of, the United States could have, they didn't necessarily do it here, but they could have formed or established the capacity and operated without the operation of a contract. And so the contract is almost, as I said, is almost secondary. What they had to do, they could have done something like, we're hereby going to take the spent nuclear fuel from TMI-2, and we're just going to put it in INL out in Butte County. And that would have established it and operated it, and the only authority they would have had to have done it is under the NWTA, and that would have met the criteria for establishing and operating and triggered the obligation of the United States to make these annual payments. So the fact that the contract may or may not comply with every nuance of the statute is, as I said, almost secondary.
Well, what's the breach of duty by the United States then?
Failure to comply with the statutory obligation.
To make
payment. To make the payment. As I said, that's much as in the case of these PILT cases, such as in Greenlee County. The statute said the secretary shall make a payment. They didn't make a payment. As a matter of fact, it's more parallel than that. Though that statute said they shall make an annual payment, and they didn't make the annual payment, and yet this court has taken jurisdiction of those cases.
That sounds like contention that this contract falls within the statute, which creates the obligation to make the payment.
Nowhere in the statute does it say that the contract is mandated. What the statute says is the obligation kicks in when they establish and operate the capacity to store the nuclear fuel. And there's no doubt that the nuclear fuel has been transitioned to Butte County in the INL, and it's there as we speak today. It's been in storage for 20 years, 25 years. So they have established and operated it, and they've done it consistent with the statute. So that kicks in the obligation. As I said, if Your Honor would look at section 101-56E1, that's where it says that when the DOE established an operation of any interim storage capacity in Butte County and is authorized under Part B of the Act, that's what triggers the obligation. As I said, here we have the fact that they have established the interim storage, both through this contract and the fact that it's there, and they are certainly operating it, because we know it's been stored there for 25 years. What the government did by storing that spent nuclear fuel...
Can I just ask this over here?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Can I just ask this question? Was this facility established before, let's say, was it 1980? When was Team... Three Mile Island, 82, 83?
It was 1979.
79. When was this facility established?
INL?
Yes.
Of 1949, I believe.
Okay. So that couldn't have been established, right?
The facility was not established.
Okay, so what do you mean by the capacity?
The capacity is basically any available space within the... there were about six of these laboratories across the United States. Any space that was available to store this kind of material at one of these six facilities, and that they would set it aside for this purpose. So that's the capacity.
So when was this capacity established at the Idaho National Laboratory?
At the earliest, it would have been 1984.
By what act?
Well, probably the contract would have established it, but... Also,
I guess that's what I was getting at. It feels to me like the establishment of the capacity may be tied to the at least offering of a contract pursuant to these provisions.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
So if the contract that DOE offered to and entered into with GPU regarding the Reactor 2 spent nuclear fuel was not pursuant to this act, then there is no capacity established under this act.
No, I think that's not correct, Your Honor, because the capacity is also reestablished or established once the spent nuclear fuel shows up there. That is not only the establishment of the capacity, but they are they're operating that capacity. So I think that in 1986 it was reaffirmed that this is the capacity, and that they were doing it under the only authority that they had in existence, which was the NWPA.
But do we have to agree with you that that was the only authority in existence in order to rule in your favor on either of the motion to dismiss, either the timeliness issue or the sort of, I don't know, cause of action issue?
I'm not positive that you have to agree with it, but I think, Your Honors, it certainly would be better if you did that, but I think that the key thing is that whether they purported to use the AEA or the NWPA is that they were doing the thing that, in fact, Congress demanded that they do, which was to provide up to 1,900 metric tons of capacity, and that's set out in Section 101.55A1. It says the Secretary shall provide. And that's what they were doing. They may have used some other mechanism, which we think was improper, but they were doing it pursuant to accomplish what the statute set out to do.
Unless the authorization of the capacity, or whatever the E language is, the establishment of the capacity authorized under this act depends on the offering of a contract, and if the Secretary had discretion about whether to enter into that contract at all, let alone whether or not the Secretary had alternative authority, why does that not fall into what we said in Hatter, characterizing Friedman and in particular the Hart decision, distinguishing it, that the original decision being complained about was a matter of discretion, that the agency actually had discretion to consider a bunch of different facts to decide whether to enter into the contract. Doesn't that put this into the Hart category, as Hatter said?
No,
cause of action arose back in 84 or 90.
No, Your Honor. The Hatter case talks about when the obligation to make the payment occurred, not the preceding. Again, if you look at Hatter, what happened is Congress passed a law.
I might have thought that, but for the discussion at the end of Hatter characterizing Hart as consistent with its ruling, and there was ever, and it was very specifically, I think, Hatter says, Hart was about the discretion in the initial decision not to pay.
No, if I beg to differ, Your Honor, I believe if you look at Hatter at page 797, it says, Congress has not interposed any administrative officer or agency to determine the claimant's eligibility.
Clearly, Congress interposed the Secretary of Energy to determine the whether to enter into the contract originally.
That may be, but it didn't determine, he was not ruling on the eligibility of anyone thereafter. And I think that's the key test.
I guess the paragraph I'm focusing on in Hatter is the paragraph that begins similarly on page 799, which is entirely about a single decision about whether the eligibility for the survivor benefits was established. I don't think there were subsequent discretionary agency decisions.
I'm sorry, which paragraph is Your Honor referring to?
On the 799 on the right-hand column, similarly, yes, you have columns. Again, similarly, the other case on which the government places reliance. And I think that's actually consistent with Friedman. I don't think Friedman limits itself to agency discretion at each of the subsequent payment choices.
No, I don't think it's at the payment point. I think that there had to have been a determination made by essentially an administrative tribunal. That's what they're really talking about here, before the payment obligation kicks in and the payment is made. So I think what you have in Hatter was the determination was made when Congress passed the statute diminishing the payment of the judge's salary, and that was made years before the claim was made, and they said that was perfectly fine.
Can I ask you just one question before? I know your time is
up. My time is up.
But, was Butte County aware of the state of Idaho's litigation back in the early 90s? Wasn't Idaho litigated with the,
yes,
with the federal government and eventually reached an agreement?
Right.
Was Butte County aware of that?
I'm sorry?
Was Butte County aware of that litigation?
It probably was, but it certainly was not a party to it.
Okay. Well, before you sit down, let me ask, how, on your theory of the case, as to which statute applies, how are you measuring your injury? What sort of damages are you looking for?
It would be the damages that the Secretary would conclude should have been the amount of the payments that should have been made. The Secretary would have to decide whether we get 10% of the construction costs, as provided in the statute, or 15% of the estimated fees, whichever is less. And that's his discretion.
Or some other number.
I'm sorry?
Or some other number.
Or some... Well, those are the maximums. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, you're correct.
Back to 2013.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Back to 2013.
Back to 2013.
Okay.
And you might be curious, we've calculated it as around $2 million a year. So it's...
Maximum.
Maximum. Yeah. Yeah, we haven't calculated the minimum.
Okay, we'll save you rebuttal time. Let's hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
Mr. Volk.
May it please the Court. Butte County failed to file its complaint within the six-year statute of limitations, and the Court of Federal Claims correctly dismissed on that basis. Even
well,
if the
what
complaint...
about the question of whether the statute is money mandating at all when there's no minimum amount that's required to be paid? And counsel has admitted that it could be a negligible amount payable. Is that a money mandating statute?
No. It's a difficult question, though, because the statute does say shall pay, but it's certainly true. It doesn't say exactly how much. There's discretion there, and so how would it be figured out now how much you get paid? It's a difficult question, but you know, to answer directly, no. How can that be mandating? What is the mandate? What is the court to say should be paid exactly? We didn't raise it in our motion to dismiss because we think there are much clearer reasons why this complaint could not go forward. And the first, which the Court of Federal Claims agreed with, of course, was the timeliness. This has to do with events from the 1980s. There's nothing that happened in the 6 years that preceded
If there had been a clear 101.56 contract, if it said on its face, this is pursuant to 101.55 and 101.56, here's the money that you, the utility, have to pay, and we're going to put it into a fund, and the government just never paid the money. That would be a clear case in which each annual failure to pay would be actionable, right?
Not as a separate cause of action. Because had there been liability, it's just like the Hart case. Had these events happened that didn't happen in the 1980s, had they happened, Butte County could have filed its complaint in the 1980s and said, you owe me this money. And what Hart...
But they can't sue until the statute provides for a yearly determination, does it not, by the Secretary as to the amount that should be paid. And so doesn't that suggest that it's a year-by-year obligation?
We don't think so. We don't see any meaningful distinction between what happened in Hart. Obviously, in Hart, the widow who said, I should still be receiving these survivor annuity payments now, all these years later.
Yeah, but in Hart, there was no yearly determination as to the amount of the payments.
Well, I think in effect there was. Those payments would vary year by year for inflation or whatever.
Well, yeah, but there's no discretionary determination being made. It's just it's a mechanical process of computing.
That may be true.
All the standards were established earlier.
That may be true, but of course the discretionary aspect of this doesn't help Butte County, because if anything, the discretionary aspect of it, to the extent there is discretion there, which appears there is, that would say that this doesn't fit within the continuing claim paradigm, that there's that discretion, so it wouldn't fit under even that factors in Hatter.
Let me just focus on this way of thinking about it. So I took the paragraph in Hatter describing Hart as saying that the basis of the challenge was to a, let's just call it for shorthand, discretionary, fact-based judgment call, discretionary decision about the survivor benefits way back when. And that makes it a case that comes outside the class of cases in which repeated payments are separately actionable. I'm going to try to avoid the term continuing claims doctrine because that only confuses me as a label. The hypothetical I was posing to you is that everybody agrees that, purely hypothetical, you entered a contract, that the contract was under 10156, and the only dispute is were annual payments made. No dispute about what happened in 1984, in March of 1984. At that point, that's not like Hart, at least as characterized in Hatter, because the wrong alleged is not one that goes back to the original time, let alone to an agency decision. The wrong alleged is only the failure to make annual payments. Isn't that the classic case in which each annual failure is separately actionable?
I don't think so, and I think there's a potentially a fact in the hypothetical that maybe isn't stated. In other words, has the government been making annual assistance payments all these years and then stops one year?
No.
Okay, so in that case, I think the result is the same. If someone comes forward 30 years later and says, and their only reason is, well, I'm still supposed to be receiving payments now, even if it's true that the payments would vary somewhat year to year, that there'd be some difference in payment, maybe it'd be a determination of what the inflation rate is that year. Whatever the reason is, even if the payments would vary somewhat, if the only claim, the only basis for saying that this is still within the statute of limitations is, and I'm still supposed to be receiving payments all these years later, we think that is within Hart and is not a timely claim. And as far as the distinction with cases like Hatter where you have questions of payroll, major distinction you have there is that you have an employee working in a pay period, earning hours. That employee wouldn't be the right word for Hatter with the judges, but you have someone working hours in a pay period and then getting paid at the end of that pay period. And that's why you have these repeated transactions. And so even in Hatter where they're describing those three factors, the first sentence of that paragraph on page 797 of Hatter, where those three factors or considerations are discussed, is the first was those cases, and these are the ones that Hatter said are continuing claim cases. The first was those cases in which the repeated government action, so you have repeated government action, distinct events.
Right, don't omit what comes in the parenthetical right after.
Or failure to act.
Or failure to act. So why isn't that contrary to I think the whole point you're making, that to get into this category, you need a series of affirmative acts, or in your case, payments, and you're alleged, I think your point, I understood your point to be, the payments are too low, but payments are coming. Doesn't this or failure to act mean that if the government just never makes any payments at all, there is no action, there's just nothing is happening, that still can come into that category?
No, I agree that omissions can be equal to acts.
Okay.
But to me, actually, the most important part of that sentence is the last part, after the parenthetical, where it says, resulted in repeated causes of action. And so whereas Butte County wants to say, well, all we should look at is those three factors that come next, the reality of this opinion and others in the pay realm is that they're already in a realm where you have repeated causes of action, you have repeated events that can be broken down into separate causes of action. And so that's when you're in that realm of those pay cases, that's when it seems reasonable to look at these three factors. But this is a case where you don't have those separate causes of action. The liability Butte claims, Butte County claims from 2013 or 2015, it all goes back. The reason they're saying the government is liable, it all goes back to what happened or didn't happen in the 1980s. And that's a fundamental difference between this situation and those payroll disputes where someone worked a certain number of hours in a pay period, then they got paid and they said they didn't get paid right, and then it happens again and again. You have separate transactions, you have people working. I couldn't go and say, next year I'm going to work so many hours for the government, you're not going to pay me right, so I'd like to get paid for that now. I couldn't do that, of course. But a situation like this, there's no reason why Butte County couldn't have made the same allegations of liability that it was owed money for the same reasons back in the 1980s.
Well, but that depends on, and I think we're now back to this case, and path that I was on might be described as a detour into hypotheticals. What I was doing with asking you about the hypotheticals was considering a situation in which the wrong alleged is not anything old. The wrong alleged is a series of continuing new wrongs, namely failure to pay on, by assumption in my hypothetical, an undisputed contract with an obligation to pay. I think your view is this case is one in which the wrong alleged is ultimately the wrong of not entering into the right contract, or at least not assuming the correct obligation back in 84.
That is how we understand Butte County's arguments. They've made slightly different arguments at different points, but that is the way we understand their argument, is saying that, sure, some of these things maybe didn't comply or didn't fit the statute exactly, but they should be deemed to, or they should have done it that way. And so, one, there's a bit of a tort problem. It's not prominent in the briefs here, but below in the briefs, there was arguments, well, the only reason it didn't comply with the statute was the DOE deliberately or negligently didn't comply with the statute. That would be a tort claim, which wouldn't be within the Court of Federal Claims jurisdiction to begin with. But a further problem with this case is that they're making a statutory claim. The county's making a statutory claim based on a statute where the agency only had authority to trigger it from 1983 to January 1st, 1990. So by 1990, the necessary prerequisites for money to be paid out under these this provision.
What's your response to Mr. Saltman's argument that the basis of the claim here is not the obligation of 10156E is not triggered by entry into a contract, but by establishment of capacity, which, as I understand his point, is not dependent on entering into a contract.
We disagree, because if you look at the statutory provision that the county is relying on, so 10156E, it says that that under subparagraph 4, payments under this subsection shall be made available solely from the fees determined under subsection A. Well, you go back to 10156A, and the title of that subsection is contracts. And more broadly, when you look at this, the statutory design of this program.
So you I think at least in your opening brief and maybe below, you focus not so much on the entirety of and the heading of 10156A1, but the particular sentence, each contract shall be determined in accordance with the provisions. Is that the sentence that you were relying on? There was a word switched, or yes, determined, right? Determined, which I think you backed off on a little bit, recognizing that that was something of an oversell.
Well, to us, the fees were never determined. Meade County says that because there was a rate schedule published, that that means the fees were determined. That's not how we read the statute. And so to us, determined, collected, it doesn't make a difference because none of it happened here. Determined, in our, as our reading of the statute is, you enter into a contract and a specific quantity is then applied against that rate schedule and you have a determination of fees and then you have a contract. But more broadly, as we look at the entirety of this subtitle, it all, the trigger is the contract. The contract, without the contract, there is no storage capacity created under this particular subtitle. And you couldn't even have the contract without the Nuclear Regulatory Commission determination, which was never made. And without the contract, you can't have any fees being paid out, impact assistance payments being made out. And then the fourth thing that we point to in particular is the purpose. You know, there's a basic mismatch between the declared purpose of the statute, which was to ensure the continued orderly operation of a reactor that maybe wouldn't have adequate storage capacity on site to keep operating. That's in the first section of the subtitle. And what Butte County is talking
this is one of the sentences in A1, is that, or what?
In 10151, B2, there's the purposes of this part, and then in B2 there, to prevent disruptions in the orderly operation of any civilian nuclear power reactor that cannot reasonably provide adequate spent nuclear fuel storage capacity at the site of such reactor when needed. And that mirrors the findings that are just above it. So
does it matter that, first of all, were there two reactors at TMI?
There were.
And that only number two melted down?
Right.
Is there any argument that you got to get rid of the junk from TMI Reactor 2 in order for TMI Reactor 1 to continue operating? Not technically operating, but safely operating.
It wasn't operating at the time. And so Butte County, the other reactor, was out
of operation. It was not, you mean even in 1979 at the accident or by 84?
Certainly by 84, I'm not certain of whether it was operating or not operating at the time of the accident.
Okay.
But Butte County has made that argument, but it just does not fit the language of what this statute says. The statute is talking about continued orderly operation. Nothing was removed from the other reactor. This material was removed from a reactor that was never going to operate again. This isn't a program that Congress had in mind for Three Mile Island. It wasn't used for Three Mile Island.
Do we have to decide that the question whether the Secretary had authority outside this act to enter into a contract to essentially take control of the 83 metric tons of spent fuel?
No, the Secretary did, but it's not necessary to decide that because that wouldn't establish the county's case. The county needs to show affirmatively that the statute it wants a payment based on applies and commands the payment to be made. Even if the department had acted totally outside of its authority, that wouldn't prove Butte County's case in that regard. It needs to affirmatively show under the statute it is relying on.
Any more questions?
No, thanks.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Saltman, you have your rebuttal.
Just briefly, Your Honor, I appreciate you giving me time. With regard to Judge Toronto's question to me earlier, I would suggest that on page 799 of the Hatter case, we look at further down on that paragraph that you cited to me. You said the because all events necessary paragraph. A few sentences below, it says, is readily apparent that this was a case, talking about Hart, in which Congress has charged an administrative agency with making a determination whether she qualified for an annuity and how much. And I think that goes to my point about they interposed someone to make that eligibility determination, not the determination Your Honor was talking about with regard to excuse me, the amounts that might have been in question or what authority that they were going to utilize. So I think that sentence is a very important explanation by the en banc court about Hart. A point that I think that the court should know is that the payments, the annual payments here would differ each year because the volume of spent nuclear fuel changes on a year-by-year basis. So payment in 2013 is not the same as it would necessarily, or not necessarily be the same as in 2014. They would be some additional fuel brought in by the Navy. I can't say to you that it actually happened in that year, but it has happened in the six-year period that the Navy has added some fuel.
Could you get payments for adverse impacts from the Navy fuel or just the TMI fuel?
I think that all spent nuclear fuel. But that's a question of quantum. But, my colleague here is talking about determined. Determined was done pursuant to the regulation, and it was done several times during the period 1984 through 1990. So I think it's pretty clear what determined means. It doesn't mean this per contract matter. They went through a federal regulatory process. Last is, Your Honor asked about PMI-2 and the fact that there were two nuclear reactors. I would ask the court to look at the regulations that came out immediately after the statute went into effect. And in it, it said nuclear reactor is exactly the same as nuclear power plant. So they were talking about there being instances where there were two nuclear reactors. And hence, the removal of the debris from TMI-2.
Did you cite these regulations in your brief? Or can you just give me the cite?
I will give that cite to you. I believe we cited it, but I'll give it to you as well, Your Honor. But it's right in the definition section. Thank you. 10 CFR section 53.2.
Thank you.
And hence, you asked a question of my colleague here as to TMI-1 and was it operating in 1984. It was shut down when the nuclear accident happened at TMI in 1979.
As you'd expect.
It did not start up again until 1985. And I think that's in our reply brief, if I'm not mistaken. Unless there are any further questions.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
This is perhaps the last time I will appear before you, and I wanted to say to you that it has been a privilege in my career to appear before this court and this panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to counsel. The case is taken under submission, and the court will stand in research in recess for about 5 minutes.
All right.